We're talking today with Terry Dietrich of American Farmers and Ranchers. Terry, let's talk about several things. I guess, first of all, you're having a series of boots-on-the-ground meetings here in the month of August. You've had one so far, and you've got three or four more still to go. Tell me a little bit about these meetings and what you've heard thus far.
Okay, Ron, this is a meeting of members, county officers, different people that are involved with us around the state. And we arrived at the boots-on-the-ground theme because it didn't make any difference what size of boots you wear or what color or what kind of shoes, for that matter. It can be sandals. But we're interested in all of our people. They're our members. And so we approach it from a very general point of view. But also one of our things that we really want to visit with them about are the issues that they are most concerned about. And, of course, today in agriculture country is the drought. And lack of hay, lack of grass, a lot of herds being liquidated. What about the tax situations? And real concerns. And then we're looking at the budget or the lack of one so far for the national. What are our people willing to give up? Because we're probably going to have to give up something. And what's their first choice to give something up?
I guess you've been in the western part of the state thus far, Elk City, and then you got a meeting still to come here tonight in Enid. But obviously that part of the world, everybody's kind of interested, you know, will there be an opportunity, a window to get some wheat in the ground for pasture?
You're exactly right. And I spoke to the Southern District of the National Association of Conservation Districts a couple of weeks ago. And one of the big issues there, dealing with crop insurance, we can have prevented planting if it's too wet and we cannot get in the field. What if it is so dry, we need to leave that residue alone? If there's no chance of a crop sprouting, are we going to be able to get the risk management people in Washington, D.C. to allow us not to go in and disturb that soil? If we do and we destroy some of the residue and then we don't get enough rain to get the crop up and we continue through a dry winter and predictions of next spring, next summer being dry, we could have some real serious wind erosion problems out there.
Let's talk about a couple of things that are going on here in the state, you know, and turn our attention to the farm policy. But water issues, we've got the Joint Legislative Committee. They've just had their first meeting. They indicate they're going to have seven or eight meetings probably before it's all said and done. This is the result of this comprehensive water plan that's now been developed. They're now going to try to take it and somehow turn it into policy.
I attended the meeting yesterday, and we listened all day to experts in the law. Oklahoma has an extremely complicated water law. Then when we involve 39 tribes and their sovereign treaties, and we start trying to decide who actually does own this water, and can we sell it, and if we do, who reaps the benefits? And, of course, we already have policy developed on that zeroes in on policy or public property rights, then if it's sold, who is rightfully entitled to some of those proceeds, at least a reasonable amount? So we're zeroing in on watersheds, but I frankly, unless we all come to the table and we all are able to reach a compromise and a situation that we can all agree with, and we wind up in the courts over ownership and the rights to, then this thing could string out for a long time.
What, you know, part of the whole issue is, are we going to move water from east to west? Are we going to move water out of state? There's like a lot of questions here, right?
Exactly. I was in one panel discussion with the town hall that we had on this, and one gentleman had the brilliant idea that said, how about we start focusing on moving the population where the water is instead of the water where the population is? Kind of an interesting concept, but maybe makes a little sense.
Let's switch over to federal farm policy, Terry. The 2012 Farm Bill, Congressman Lucas has said all along he wanted to wait until next spring, early summer, to actually write the bill. Thought he would have a better idea on budget and a better opportunity to have a reasonable budget at that time. I guess the super committee, though, from the deficit deal that was made a few weeks ago, that really changes maybe the whole parameter of the debate as far as how much money's there.
Yes, we were really worried about the super committee, and would there be anybody on there that had any idea about how agriculture programs work and the value of them to the American consumer and the national security of this country. Max Baucus from Montana has been a warrior for agriculture, and he was selected to serve on the Senate side of that super committee. And we're watching to see what comes from it. We know that probably everybody's going to take cuts, even though less than 1/4 of 1% of our budget goes toward the basic programs. You know, people look at how many dollars are in the farm bill, but they don't realize that between 60% and 70% of that are welfare programs, school lunches, food stamps, women, infants, children, etc. And they've got to come, that money's got to come from somewhere. And of course, at one time, we had enough farm population we could pass a farm bill. When that number decreased to the point that we didn't have the representation in Washington, D.C. and the power to do that, then the welfare people were brought in because they consume our product. And then conservation has gotten really involved. And then that brought on the wildlife people. And we got to keep all of those working together in order to be able to get enough votes to pass a farm bill and keep food for this country. Now, the risk that we're running is that some of those programs, such as the Wetlands Reserve Program, is expiring in 2012. There are no baseline funds for that. So where do we find a place for that? And when we do, will it be so diluted that we lose the support of Ducks Unlimited? We have to have the support of a lot of those people to stand by us on other crucial points of the Farm Bill. So it's going to be an interesting thing. And when I say that I'm asking our people to tell me what are you willing to give up, I don't want that to be taken negatively. We face reality, but before we get there, we're going to fight tooth and toenail for everything we can to keep. And it's not just for our farmers. It's on behalf of this country.
One area that is continuing to kind of unfold a little bit regarding policy up in D.C. is just a few days ago, Secretary Vilsack unveiled a proposed rule on animal ID or animal traceback. I know that you've kind of been involved with a lot of these discussions all the way back to about a decade ago now, when we right after 2003 and the cow that stole Christmas. We had obviously a lot of urgency to get some sort of an animal ID traceback system in place then, up and down since that time.
If we would have been able to strike when the iron was hot, we could have already had this thing done. A lot of people disagreed with it because they misunderstood it. I held a lot of meetings, and when I really explained what it was all about, I never left a meeting that I didn't have the consensus of the people that this is something that would help the industry. But since then, it has been modified a great deal. And we just had premise ID. And to identify the premise, and that doesn't mean you identify every place that you have cattle. It means you identify your headquarters. And it's simply for a notification process that if there is a disease sweeping through the country and they know that on your premise, let's say there's a horse disease, they know on your premise you've listed that you have horses, then they can get the word out to you, hey, you better get to vaccinating for this disease that's coming through. Or take precautions. So that was the intent of that. Now, I sat in the Southern Plains Beef Symposium a week ago and listened to a gentleman from the meat export people, and he talked about what other countries are doing. And we're one of the few that does not identify the origin of our animals. And right now, with animal disease traceback, the only time this will come into effect is if there is an animal disease that we need to get in front of. They know where this animal has been and what all has been exposed. And, you know, we did a tabletop early on a few years ago and found out that from the Oklahoma City National Stockyards, within 5 days, trucks and or cattle touched 35 states. Imagine what that could be if terrorists wanted to take advantage of that. Or a foot and mouth disease, anything. And it helps us to be able to trace where did it come from, where did we pick it up, and where do we stop it. So it's an important thing for our industry. One of the things that makes it more important today is because we transfer cattle across the United States. You know, 30, 40 years ago, that was unheard of. They went from the farm to town, from town to the feedlot and slaughter. But that's not the way it is anymore.
So the proposed plan that Mr. Vilsack's got is, you know, it really puts a lot of emphasis back on the states. Is it good enough?
I think it will be. And, of course, this will be something that will develop over the next several years as they find flaws and they find inadequacies. But it's a good place to start. It considers the states. It considers the preferences in the states. There are some that want to stay with the hot iron brand. I'm yet to figure out why, if we can brand a calf, why it's so much trouble to spend another 10 or 15 seconds to put a tag in their ear. But nevertheless, that's something that's near and dear to a lot of cowboys in a lot of states. We use hot iron brand here, but only to help identify our cattle from someone else's, and in case of theft, it helps. But as we go forward, it considers the states, it considers the tribes, and the animal health officials within those, and we'll just have to put it together, put it out there. I think this is a good place to start. I think it's good for the industry. I can tell you after the Christmas cow of 2003, I had enough money borrowed on stalker calves that the next morning after this word came out and the price had fallen out of sight, basically wasn't a price till they began to get their handle on it, I was bankrupt. And I don't want that to happen again. And I'm glad that it was a dairy cow and not some horned Hereford off of a 5,000-acre ranch in Wisconsin. We still wouldn't know where she came from. So this is one of those important things that I think we really need to, for the times that we're living in today. And I do believe there's going to be a premium. The gentleman I listened to was talking about in Japan, they have a barcode on each package of meat in Japan. And that barcode will tell you what farm it came from, even, and what it's been fed, etc. We don't want to go that far, and there's no need to go that far, but I think there's going to be a premium in the future for people who can say, this is where this animal was sourced. This is the beginning, the origin of this animal, and here's where it's been. And people will know that when they buy the meat.